Hey, it's Tony. On today's show, we will talk to Sally Jenkins about her involvement in the Netflix documentary about Chris Everett and Martina Navratilova. We'll also talk to Bob Ryan about why the Celtics traded Jaylen Brown to the 76ers for basically nothing. But first, commerce.
Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
When the Dutch coach came off the field, they said, "Have you already resigned?" That's a tough crowd, right?
It is a tough crowd, but it's no different than Bo Schembechler at Michigan, right? You know when the Michigan fans say, "He's a Michigan man." You follow where I'm going with this?
Yes, yes, yes.
Ronald Koeman is 100% Dutch, and he managed that game as if he hated the Dutch. I've never seen...
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
Let's do an announcement first, because this is a big deal to me. This comes from Nancy Conravy in Abita Springs, Louisiana, if I pronounce that correctly. And so would you please tell all the littles out there that the U.S. Adaptive Open is again at Woodmont Country Club in Rockville, Maryland on July 6th through 8th. It's
amazing,
an amazing event.
Event.
That's what she says. So do you, that everyone would enjoy watching whether they enjoy golf or not. Admission is free, so... spend some time being inspired. Do you want to explain what it is?
And what's so great about this is they have parking is available. It's right across from the Best Buy, right off of the Pike, and you can enter directly onto the course. I think it puts you out on like hole number 12 or 13. And this is a golf course that is designed to be inclusive of players of all abilities. So you look out there and you see players driving carts into bunkers, driving up onto greens, playing tees that stretch all the way from what you would consider tournament tees that you see sort of every weekend wherever you're playing, and you have tees that go all the way up, you know, an extra 100, 200 yards in the fairway. It's a wonderful event.
Can you explain who the golfers are and why they're doing
these are
this?
Golfers that have different disabilities, and there are different categories.
Physical and yes. And mm-hmm. Cognitive.
Yeah, I mean, I can pull up the full list of as to what are the qualifications.
It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And again, a USGA event, this is different than just playing golf with your friends. Every single putt goes in the hole, and to see the players play through everything, every possibility.
It is inspirational. There's nobody who's ever gone to it who hasn't come back teary-eyed, saying that was a wonderful, wonderful thing. So we mentioned that. There's nothing much to talk about with the Nats. Did not play last night, except for the suspensions.
A couple Nats are sitting down.
Yeah, Wilson Contreras was suspended for 7 games. Cade Cavalli for 7 games. Meatball Mikolas suspended for 3 or 4 games. This has no real effect on,
it's a start,
on
right?
Mikolas. None, because he's a starter. Cavalli will miss 1 start. Wilson Contreras going to miss 7 games.
Miss 7 games.
It's different.
Yeah.
It's different. A pitcher and a starting pitcher, not a relief pitcher, would be a different deal too. But so the Nats came out of that better than Wilson Contreras came out
of
that.
But do you really think that's going to derail the Red Sox in their quest to be the worst
team? The Red Sox aren't any good. Speaking of baseball, the Padres stink. They lost the other day 22-3 to the Cubs. They led the Dodgers last night 6-0 and lost 12-7. They have spent a tremendous amount of money. Tremendous. Wilbon always roots for them.
You're getting close to a decade of this.
Yeah. Tremendous amount of money on players like Machado and Tatis and some pitchers. They stink. That manager is going to be fired. He's going to be the fourth manager this year to be fired. The first one was the Phillies. The second one was the Red Sox. The third one was the Mets. And the fourth one's going to be the Padres. They're going to have to fire him. Let me get to the World Cup now.
Let's see you try and explain VAR, Tony.
I can't explain VAR. What VAR is...
it's a computer chip.
Yeah, it's a computer chip that isolates where people are physically at any moment in time. And it comes up because, much like in football... soccer has gone to technology whenever it is available, even though it ruins the flow of the game, and even though people, I'm not sure people like it. Maybe half do, maybe half don't. I don't know. It's not as smooth and as clean as tennis or balls and strikes, and it has much greater effect, much greater effect. I'm not the world's biggest soccer person. I was watching last night Croatia against Portugal. I was just, was on, and I just watched it, and I saw a few minutes of it. Well, let's not go crazy here. I saw a few minutes of it. There was a call made. Cristiano Ronaldo, one of the greatest soccer players of all time, has never, ever, ever had a goal in a knockout round match. Never.
Let's see if we can change that.
Right. So at one point, there's some action around the goal. It's Croatia against Portugal. There's some action around the goal, and it is determined by video that the Croatian guy fouled the Portuguese guy. And so a penalty kick was awarded, and Ronaldo took it, and he nailed it. Got his first goal ever. This was his ninth knockout round match. He's one of the great, like he'd been a dog in these kinds of games. If he'd been Messi and Wilbon hated him, Wilbon would have destroyed him. But Wilbon likes Ronaldo. So he got this goal. Later on, they were in that thing where you don't know how much time is left.
And extra time.
There's no clock. You don't really know. It's at the discretion of somebody.
Even then, you're just waiting for the whistle.
You don't know. You don't know what's going on. With what seemed to be about 3 seconds left, Croatia scored a goal. And they took it down.
Hmm.
They consulted these video things, and they took it down. That's difficult for me. I'm not saying it's wrong, but it takes away often from the flow of the game and the spirit of the game. There's one other thing that happens, and then Michael has something to talk about. He noticed something else. One of the things that bothers me in soccer is the flopping. It's like Joel Embiid times 10 million. People anticipate contact, go down, hold their knees, hold their ankles, hold their groins, whatever it is, and writhe around in pain, looking to get a penalty on somebody else. As soon as the ball is put back in play, they're up, they're ready to play, everything is great. So they're frauds. Yeah. And it's not one or two guys, it's everybody.
It's the entire field.
It's everybody's a fraud.
No, actually, when they're trying to do it just to slow the game down and get like a little break, obviously before they started the hydration break, I'm actually okay with that.
The hydration break?
No, I'm okay if like if you want to just take an extra, take an extra half a minute.
But what you're not okay with is
all the holding.
Yes.
So when you think about the impact of these VAR calls, you have every single play is being held, and those are the moments that actually seem to have an impact on the pace of play and the rhythm of the game and the potential for scores or offensive moves that come 3, 4, 5, 6 passes down the field. But man, apparently the VAR stuff happens every single week. We're just not paying attention to it because we watch the World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time that we're really exposed to soccer. Please don't tell me it's a beautiful game. Please just
the other thing is that you're trying
refrain from telling me it's a beautiful game.
It's,
say you like it.
Honestly, it's like what you see every weekend in football where you freeze frame anything and you can see hold, and then it comes down to the eternal question of is it a catch or not a catch, and they try and predict here's the natural motion that we expect a player to continue with if he was actually pushed versus if he falls or flops.
The difference is there is so much fewer goals.
Yes.
In soccer, football has more scoring. Excuse me.
Well,
baseball
at the end of the
has
game,
more scoring.
You look at the Bills. I mean, there's
okay, but the odds of one of those calls affecting the outcome of a soccer game is far greater,
yes,
proportionately than affecting the outcome of other sporting procedures. It just is, and I don't know. I'm not a soccer guy, but if you find fault with it like this, the soccer poets go insane.
Yes, they do.
You know, and just
it's the knowing glances that you see on the players as the camera goes, around the field, and they look happy that they're getting away with something.
Sure.
Yes. Yes.
They're trained to defraud the game and use that to their advantage. I get that. It's okay, but it appears to have proportionally a greater impact on their game than a call in a football game or a call in a basketball game. It's like 10,000 calls.
Yes. Yeah.
No, this is...
Well, the closest thing
you would have
seen...
You took away this kid's goal.
No, the closest thing you'd see would be something that could lead to a suspension in a future game, the same way you're seeing that play out with either a yellow or a red card.
So the red card that the American guy got, and he's a very great player, he's as important, everybody tells me, as Pulisic is, maybe more important. The red card prevents you from playing the next day, and if you do look at the contact, it doesn't look...
No.
It neither looks intentional nor terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't. Most of these things at least look intentional.
Yeah, that...
That didn't really look intentional.
Right, and then you think about time served for the rest of that game and what it meant.
Yeah, well...
Well, it really put you all in jeopardy for that match, you know?
Against Belgium.
Well, the next one, yeah. Well,
we have Belgium.
Yes.
They put us in jeopardy for that one, except that Bosnia-Herzegovina isn't any good.
Yes.
They're ranked 61st in the world, and we're ranked 15th.
Belgium will present lots of difficulties.
Well, that's, yeah, that, I mean, Belgium is a different kettle, you know. But Belgium's not Spain.
No.
Belgium's not Argentina.
No.
Belgium's not France.
No.
You know, it's Belgium.
Didn't mention England.
Well, England's getting hosed.
Thank you. I was about to say.
England's getting hosed. They have to go play at altitude a mile and a half up. Is it in Mexico City?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's in Azteca Stadium, where in 89 games, the Mexican national team in 89 games has lost twice. England has no chance.
A home match for them at altitude. It just seems like they're saying to us, no, we don't want England to ever win.
No, England, no. And the coach even said we have no chance to acclimate. No, they have no chance.
Yeah, I don't know what.
That seems unfair.
It feels a bit unfair. Yes.
It seems unfair. All right, we'll take a break. We have a very generalist kind of show today.
Yeah.
Generalist journalist.
What we
have
love.
Sally Jenkins and Bob Ryan on the show today. And we will be back with Sally when we return. Yes?
That's right.
I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Heather Lloyd. This is a song called If We Come Too Late. And I have a note here from Ronnie Neumeier that says it's been a minute or two, but I wanted to let you know that Friday, July 10th, that's next Friday, at the Birchmere in Alexandria, Neumeier Flyer is presenting the Simon & Garfunkel Songbook, a full band tribute covering all the Simon & Garfunkel hits and deep cuts. Tickets are on sale at the Birchmere official website. Show features the vocal and instrumental talents of Tom and Mark Lofgren, Heather Lloyd, and Kippen Martin. Your fine podcast has played songs by all of them previously. Heather, who's singing now, has a new album out called Panic Room with a View, and I've attached one of the songs from that album called If We Come Too Late. I also have a song from Kippen Martin called Madeline. So we will hear that later in the show, and you can buy tickets to that, and it's going to be good because everything
yes,
you do is really good.
Phenomenal.
It plays in Sally Jenkins, and the woman to whom I related by marriage about a week ago asked me if I saw this documentary on Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert, and I said no because I don't even know how to use the TV anymore. I've stopped watching television. If it's not the Nats, you know, and I don't know that Chrissy and Martina are playing second and short, so no. But I said, is Sally in it? And you said, yes, Sally's in it, because I immediately thought of the story, Sally, that you wrote a couple of years ago that should have won a Pulitzer Prize on their relationship. Tell us about the documentary and tell us your relationship to it.
Well, first off, they really give it up in the documentary. I mean, the thing that makes it good is Martina and Chris, they let cameras follow them into meetings with cancer doctors where they don't get great news. I mean, there's Martina lets someone stick a tube down her throat on camera. I mean, it's pretty grainy. It's good stuff. It's a lot better than most sports documentaries, you guys, I think, will agree, is pretty slick hagiography, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing I love about this documentary is that it's not that. It's the tennis really holds up. It's riveting. Their relationship is riveting. So I'm really proud of it. I have a couple of different involvements. I wrote a story for the Washington Post that it's essentially, I think the film is triggered by that story, and it's sort of based on that story. And then I have a producer credit on the film. I did some work on the film. I went with Martina back to Czechoslovakia, to the Czech Republic, and did the interviews over there with that whole segment that's in the film about her defection and her family and all of that stuff. So, I was pretty involved in it. The director, Rebecca Gitlitz, though, she's the one who really made it happen. She got a level of trust from them that really makes the film.
Have they mentioned the film to you? Are they happy with it? Or is one happy and not the other? Are both happy or both unhappy?
I think they're both happy with it. It was at the Tribeca Film Festival. It premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, and they were both there with their families, and they seemed really, really pleased with the film. Chrissy thinks that she always comes off as the villain, which is pretty funny because that's a flip of their playing relationship.
Yeah. Do they continue to be best pals, right?
They're very close, yeah. They have a kind of a black box relationship, Tony. You can tell when you're with them in the room that there's stuff between them that nobody else gets, you know? Mm-hmm. You can feel it, right? Like, there's stuff they've only said to each other. Like, even their spouses don't understand what it's like to play a final on center court, you know, against the other great player of the epoch. And they know things that no one else really can know.
I cancer, covered them.
Cancer is like that. Cancer is like that too, by the way. Yeah. You know, unless you've actually felt chemo, I don't think anybody knows what chemo feels like except someone who's been through it.
So I covered them. I go all the way back. First time I ever covered Forest Hills was Chris Evert's ultimate semifinal match on center court with Billie Jean King. I mean, she just burst upon the scene, like, as Bruce Springsteen would say, a supernova. And Martina, when she defected, I mean, this is a huge story. I have an awareness of them. I have an appreciation for their intellect. I always thought Martina was just about the smartest athlete I ever was around. Chris announced that her cancer had returned. This was about a week ago. This is, I think, the cancer that she lost her sister to as well. Were you... I don't know how to ask. You're a pal of
it's
hers.
Okay.
She does. Yeah, she did this publicly. You know, I wondered, do you have to do it publicly? Has she reached that point in her life where it is important to do it publicly because it helps others?
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole deal with both of them is they, you know, they're all about, you know, early detection. And, you know, Chrissy's fortunately was detected early. If it hadn't been, you know, she might not be with us right now. It's given her the ability to fight. So, yeah, the reason they went public with it is they want women to get checked regularly, and because that's the lifesaver here. They're also, you know, I said this in the film. It's a funny relationship because, you know, Chrissy early in her career in 73, when you were at that Open at Forest Hills, which I would have given anything to have seen. She put her armor on early, and she's been slowly but surely taking her armor off ever since. Martina was the opposite. You know, she comes to this country very guileless, very naive, very sort of open, because she grew up in this communist country where you had to, you know, you couldn't speak openly. And she has gone in the opposite direction. She's actually put some armor on as she's gotten older and more experienced. And so it's a very interesting thing, but both of them are very open about their cancer and about their relationship now and what competition did to them, how it damaged the friendship for a while, how they managed to put it back together, you know. And I really respect that because for Chrissy, it's not easy. It doesn't come natural, you know, especially. And for Martina, it doesn't come natural anymore. And so they really made an effort here to kind of bear themselves, which I appreciate a lot about the film.
So, you know, I remember very few things in my life other than rock and roll songs. But I do remember when Martina defected. And I remember that within, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, she had gained about 20 pounds.
Yeah, the
and
pancakes.
And she said, well, you know, I can't believe I can walk into a supermarket and there's food. So I buy the food and I eat the food. And then she got lean again and became the most fit tennis player of all time. But she ballooned. You remember that, don't you?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Well, look, you know, one of the things I learned going to the Czech Republic with her was, you know, I didn't realize just how poor she was growing up. I mean, they had the basics that they needed, but they lived in basically her and her sister and her parents. There was no hot water. Her father found an old boiler and tried to rig it up, so they finally had some hot water in the house. But, you know, she grew up, they went to the tennis club, the little local tennis club, because they were to take a hot water shower. They lived in basically in a very small sort of essentially a studio apartment that was so small they kept their shoes out in the hallway, you know, things like that. You know, she grew up with not a lot, I'll just tell you that. And, you know, to come to this country, I think she was bedazzled by just the plenitude.
Yeah. I mean, that happened to a lot of hockey players who defected early also. Their families would just go and eat. They would just, because they were afraid. I think Martina once said this. She said, I went there one night. I thought it couldn't happen again in the morning. So I went back in the morning and bought more food because, you know, who knows when the food is going to run out. I mean, Chris Evert grew up the child of a tennis teaching pro. I mean, you know, comfortably middle class family, I would say, right?
Yeah, I would say, yeah. I mean, look, her dad taught tennis at public. You know, he was not some guy giving lessons in Palos Verdes. You know, he was giving $4 an hour tennis lessons at the public courts in Fort Lauderdale at Holiday Park. Mm-hmm. And they had, and you know, they had four kids. I mean, I don't think that was a sumptuous upbringing either. You know, I think it was a crowded house. And I think Jimmy Everett, her dad, had a lot of integrity. He refused to raise his prices once his daughter became a star, which was, I think, she gets her integrity from him, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, so I think that they were both kids that were isolated in a lot of ways. You know, Chrissy was taught by her father, you can't have friends, you have to practice all the time, you can't go to sleepovers, you can't go to birthday parties. And then, you know, Martina, of course, came from this very isolated country. And so they were alone, you know, these two kids. They were really alone. Martina, you'll see in the documentary, the first tournament she wins, she doesn't have anyone to hug. She's over here. She wins a tournament. There's no one to hug. So she hugs a post, a telephone pole. And there's a picture of that in the film. You know, they were really lonely kids, and they kind of sought each other out, you know, when they're 15, 16 years old, and they become very close friends as young teenagers.
Where is the documentary airing? What channel?
It's on Netflix.
Netflix.
You can get it on demand on Netflix.
You pay for that. I think Carol pays for Netflix, which means I pay for Netflix. I've never actually seen it. Don't know what it is. All right. Have you been paying attention to Wimbledon? What do you think of Serena coming back?
I loved it. 44 years old against a 20-year-old when you haven't played in 4 years and you've got two children, one of them 3 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, it was remarkable. The fact that she pushed Maya Joint to the wall was remarkable to me. I mean, she looked rusty. She didn't look old.
Yes.
That was what was interesting. Was she looks like she's 2 weeks of match play away from being able to, you know, be a quarterfinalist, be a semifinalist, and if you can get
really?
There, anything can happen.
Really?
Yeah.
Semifinalist.
Well,
okay.
Who do you quarterfinalist? Let's start with the quarters. But Tony, who do you see out there who can really threaten Serena? I mean, with 120 mile an hour
Sabalenka.
Serve,
that one, Sabalenka.
Sabalenka.
Yeah.
Sabalenka. Who else?
I don't know. I don't know any of their names anymore because women's tennis has sort of gone the opposite way of men's tennis. Has two people that everybody knows and everybody wants to see them play, and women's tennis every other major is a new person who you've never heard of winning. So it,
or Coco Gauff. Coco Gauff is a legit great player.
Yeah.
But you know, look, when you have Serena's mental fortitude, you know that if you can achieve a certain level of consistency, in addition to having those weapons that you have, you know, the forehand.
You think she'll stay out there?
I think she's going to make a decision. I think she's probably feeling her way through. But here's the thing. You can beat people in the head before you ever go out there if you're Serena. So, like, you know that if you can keep the ball in the court a certain amount of time, the person on the other side is going to make an error. Right. And that's what I see. I don't see too many people who can keep the ball in play enough. And I think that that may be one reason why she's playing footsie with this whole idea. You know?
Have you been watching the telecasts at all? I mean, other than
sure.
Serena?
Sure.
How great is Andy Roddick?
He's
I had no
fabulous.
Idea.
And he's been fabulous. He's been fabulous. If you listen to his podcast. Look, one of the great frustrations.
He's got a podcast, too. Everybody's got a podcast.
His podcast is heaven.
Oh my God. Really?
His podcast is the best, one of the best things in tennis. No, he's terrific. Here's the thing. I wrote about this a while ago, about a year ago. John McEnroe's chokehold on tennis commentating and a few other people out there, too, has been really frustrating because if you really follow the game, you know that there are commentators out there that are so brilliant. Andre Agassi, without even trying, is one of the most interesting commentators in tennis already.
I've never heard of him.
Oh, yeah. Agassi and Roddick are the two best commentators on men's tennis right now, and they should be on air a lot more than they are.
Roddick's really good. I haven't heard Agassi. Roddick is really good. Oh, one last thing. I know that you're not at the Washington Post. You're at the Atlantic. I get that. But your entire career, you had the opportunity to see and think about Alexander Ovechkin, who's coming back at least for one more year. Are you okay with that? Do you think it's good? Do you think, no, get out of here?
No. I love it when athletes do this because we're all wrong about the age thing in sports. I mean, if we don't know that by now, after this year, you know, Lindsey Vonn wins a bunch of World Cup races. You know, Serena comes back and goes three sets at Wimbledon on center court at the age of 44. I mean, you know, we're really kind of robbing ourselves of these fabulous third acts when we push athletes to retire prematurely. You know, things that athletes do when they're past it are some of the most fun things I've ever watched. Remember Jimmy Connors as Mr. Midnight at the U.S. Open?
Yes, I do. I was there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, these things can be spectacular if we allow athletes the sort of room and ego to pursue them.
Okay. I'll ask you one more question. Are you going to the Taylor Swift wedding at Madison Square Garden tomorrow?
I wish. I'd love to hear the post-wedding concert. You know?
Yeah, that's the thing. Who's going to play? If you've rented out the garden, who's going to come and play, right? I mean, that's...
Well, I got to think Stevie Nicks. I have to think Stevie Nicks, who's like apparently one of her best friends ever. And I have to think Haim.
Yeah.
And I have to think maybe like a Keith Urban or somebody.
Do you think she'll get up there? So you don't think the zombies are going to play? I was hoping for the zombies.
No, I think playing music.
Do you think she'll get up there?
Sort of, I think playing music might be her favorite thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't she strike you that way? Like, you know, it's not her work; it's her life. She lives music.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't know who's invited.
The National, maybe the National. Those guys are great.
I don't know any of these people. You know, I don't know any of them. That would be great if you went. Anyway,
Bon Iver.
Sal.
Bon Iver. Do you know Bon Iver?
No, but I know Bonnie
Tony.
Raitt.
Michael, get him up to speed.
Bonnie
Raitt
is my age. After a Vegas cancellation.
Yeah. Bonnie Raitt is my age. I know her.
I'm sorry.
Jackson Brown, Bonnie
James
Raitt.
Taylor.
I know
who that
is. James Taylor. I know James Taylor.
The association?
The association I doubt is going to make it. I doubt it. So maybe they'll fly the Stones over. Who knows? That
would be great.
All right. Thanks, Sal.
Loved it. Love talking to you guys.
Sally Jenkins, boys and girls. Just lovely. We'll take a break. We'll bring in Bob Ryan, the quintessential American sports writer. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Kippen Martin, a song called Madeline. And once again, next Friday night at the Birchmere in Alexandria, Neumeier Flyer, Ronnie Neumeier and pals are presenting Simon and Garfunkel's songbook. Everybody's going to be there.
That's going to be
fantastic.
I'm
not going to be there. Well, I don't go out. But if I did go out, I would go.
Yes.
So I don't drink beer all the time, but when I do, I drink this. Yeah. And this song, Michael, if people, independent artists, want to get their music played on this show, how do they do it?
Send us some music by emailing it to jingles@tonykornheisershow.com. And a big month ahead, we have a promo code at Johnny O, TK, B-Day.
Ooh. Oh, yes, my birthday.
Big birthday coming up, sharing with the Hammer. I can't double up with certain summer sales they have, but go check it out.
Okay, thank you. Kippen plays in Bob Ryan, the quintessential American sports writer. There's a trade, I don't know, 36 hours ago, something like that, that Boston made with Philadelphia that is, in my mind, are you kidding me? That Boston trades Jaylen Brown, a guy that I thought was the MVP of the league last year, for the incredibly overrated, overpaid, non-productive Paul George. That's it. I mean, you can say there's two number ones, but if Boston, you know, and Philadelphia play well, those number ones are, you know, 26, 27, 28. They're not valuable number ones. You've spent your life paying attention to basketball and certainly the Boston Celtics and everything about basketball in New England. What do you make of this trade?
When I first had I heard about it while driving, I may have driven off the road. But fortunately, I was landlocked. We knew something. You know, all right. Here's my position. When all this was playing out about what's going to happen with Brown, I said publicly and privately, "In Brad, I trust. If Brad makes a deal, okay. If Brad doesn't make a deal, okay. Well, now I'm saying, what was I thinking? And my theory I'm working on, Tony, is that the 76ers have kidnapped Brad Stevens and replaced him with an AI-generated robot in Boston. It's stunning. Not that he was traded, but you got to get something better. And everyone, and I mean capital E, boldface, everyone agrees to that, that no one in the league can understand. And many other reasons, not only is he... I won't go so far as to say he's 36. He's not, his best days are behind him, but the contract is onerous. If you were to take a poll of general managers in the league, I would bet and say, who's got the worst contract in the league? And I think the majority would say Paul George. And the Celtics took this thing on. The draft picks, there's lots of swapping involved, yeah, potentially, and if that and the other things. You can't keep track of it all. Although my favorite analysis of it, my colleague at the Boston Globe, Gary Washburn, said that the 2031 pick that they're going to get is a 14-year-old kid awaiting his first game with the AAU. So I like that. But it's stunning. We weren't ready for this to be the outcome of the Brown thing.
So, much like you, having watched Brad Stevens over the years, I assumed there was another move coming, that this was part one of part two or part three. Is there another move coming?
That is, to me, a highly logical, that is my logical assumption. Now, I just glanced at the paper, there's sort of a semi-categorical statement that they don't have anything else planned. I can't believe that. I can't believe that this isn't the beginning of something. I can't believe they're going to think they're going to go start the 26-27 season with this is core roster without adding to it or changing it in some way as it now stands. They've added Mitchell Robinson, and you go, that's another story for another day, because there's a highly flawed player who's got one enormous upside. He's the best offensive rebounder in the league, and yes, I really believe he is.
Yeah, but you can't put him on the foul line. You can't.
And the downside is you can't keep him in the game at times. So we know that. They know that because Joe Mazzulla was a leading hacker Mitch guy last year.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing, interesting thing that about Brown, I'm just throwing it out there because, you know, I'm not a big major fan of analytics in any sport. They've taken over to the detriment of our interest in the game and our enjoyment of the game. But, you know, you're probably well aware that there are analytics that range from him being the 11th best player in the league to the 51st best player in the league. And that there is an irrefutable number that the Celtics actually were better off with him,
yes,
off the floor last,
yes,
year than on.
8-2 when he was off the floor last year, 36-6 in the last three seasons. I look at this, I said this last night on PTI, maybe this is analytics, but because I can't believe these numbers. He's too good for that. I can't believe the numbers.
Well, I know it. So maybe Brad's smarter than we think, even that. I mean, we thought he was pretty smart. So there's contradictory evidence there, you know, about Brown. We know what we saw. What we saw was a guy who was 10 years, was one of the top, the worst you could say, 15 players in the league, and you know, could easily have been first team all league this year. Nothing against Cade Cunningham, but you could easily replace him with Jaylen Brown, and many of us thought they should have. He's a quality asset to a team. There's no question in my mind. I don't care about these analytics, but it's caught everybody. You know, we're stunned and wondering, you know, what is the ultimate motivation here, in terms of, you know, why couldn't they wait? There's all kinds of serious scenarios where they could have waited and not made this particular deal for Paul George. I saw one number today that I didn't know about. I had forgotten about, by the way, in the analysis of George, and we all agree he's over the hill and all that, and he's injury-prone, but he was 22 for 40 on threes against the Celtics in the playoffs last year. You know, maybe that resonated in Brad's head. I don't know.
Why? Let's go backwards. Why do you think they traded Jaylen Brown at all? Why?
That's the thing. The parlor game we play is what's the difference? What is the relationship on and off the floor between he and Jason Tatum? And to the best of our knowledge, they certainly get along. They're not enemies or anything. There's kind of an inherent battle about supremacy, perhaps, on the team when the game starts. We thought they had conquered that. They have won a championship together.
Yes.
They have done it, and it's not that easy. You know, you don't ever poo-poo a championship. People are doing it by saying, well, when they beat teams that were missing some guys. Well, they did. Well, these things happen all the time. Bill Russell's teams did, too. Nobody's questioning those championships. So, that's a good question. What is the inner dynamic there that we can only guess? I thought it was working fine. you know, Tatum's, you know, but in Brown's mind, maybe he thinks he's a better player. He's not. Tatum is a better player. But the need to trade him, I didn't think it was acute, frankly,
right.
from my outsider's viewpoint. But as I said, if Brad, I'll go back to what we started with. If Brad chose to do it, I'll set myself up. I am a huge Brad Stevens admirer and fan. I consider him to be a friendly acquaintance, as a matter of fact. And now I really like this guy, and I think he's done a fantastic job. His talent judgments have been really tremendous. We've had no negative things to say about him from the minute he came here as a young coach, and this is the first time that there's reason to question him and about what he's thinking, and he hasn't spoken yet, and that's what we're waiting for. Everyone's waiting to hear Brad's rationale. We haven't had it yet.
In division to a rival, making that other team now, making Philadelphia better than Boston right now. What?
Better, no question. They're a threat to the Knicks now. If they're blessed with good health, you know, we know that. That's the given in every sport all the time, if they're blessed with good health. But if they are blessed with good health at the right time, they've got a tremendous top three with four, with Embiid, Maxey, Brown, and VJ Edgecombe.
Yeah.
If the Celtics had managed to pry VJ Edgecombe, we would have felt a little bit better about this. A young stud. That VJ Edgecombe, I'm telling you, he may be Andrew Toney on training wheels. Keep your eye on that kid. He's really good. And they now have four really solid quality players to start with. And they're much better. I mean, you wake up in Philadelphia and your team is much better today than it was yesterday. You've got a smile on your face.
They could go after LeBron now. LeBron's going to play for a buck and a half. They could go after LeBron.
That's the great part. There's so many possible scenarios about that. I think the greatest one that for LeBron would be San Antonio, be the big brother for you know who.
Yeah, for Wembanyama. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be good?
Are you following the World Cup, by the way?
Oh, avidly. I'm so fascinated by it. I'm just reading now and marveling about yesterday. And I hate offside in all sports. I detest offside. It's the most useless thing in sport. And somebody lost a goal with the buzzer last day.
Croatia.
Yeah. On an offside, a stupid offside. But I'm following this. I'm following our team. I'm following all the story. I'm interested in Argentina, Cape Verde today, just because of those plucky Cape Verde guys. Oh, yeah, I'm all over it. I'm really enjoying it.
Do you think we have a chance to get to the final eight?
I think, yes, we have a chance. We got a tough game with Belgium. We have a chance. We have a puncher's chance in that game, that's for sure. And if we do that, we have totally accomplished our goal. We've accomplished our goal already. I mean, we had to do this. We had to get this far. We couldn't get, Tony, your favorite new verb. We didn't get grouped, Tony.
No, that's right. Right. We didn't get grouped.
We didn't get grouped. So yeah. that was the number one thing. We couldn't afford to get grouped. So we're doing fine. And beat Belgium, and it's a success. And then anything that happens from here on is a disappointment, but not a disaster.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. This guy already, Pochettino, already is the greatest coach that we've had in the history
of
American World Cup. He's from Argentina, and Kelleher pointed out to me that after the game, he was singing Take Me Home, Country Roads, to the place I belong, West Virginia. He's never been to West Virginia. He doesn't know where it is. No chance.
You don't think he paid a visit to Jerry West,
I don't. Cabin Creek? I don't think so.
Cabin Creek was more euphonious. He's actually lived in Chelan, Cheylan. A little bit of Jerry West trivia for you.
That's good to know. Yeah. Pochettino. Thanks, Bobby. Thank you.
Okay. Anytime, Tony. Bye-bye.
Bob Ryan, quintessential American sports writer. He knows all about the Celtics. Nobody understands this. Not even Wilbon, who likes Paul George, understands this.
It's baffling.
Nobody understands this. We will take a break. We will come back with email and jingle. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Here comes Tony's mailbag. Got your emails, faxes, and your notes. Here comes Tony's mailbag. Gonna read some for all you folks.
thanks to Ronnie Neumeier and Tom Lofgren for that rendition that we liked very, very much. You want to do the Bethesda Bagel ad?
Yes, Bethesda Bagels. We love them. You will as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com for the location in the D.C. area nearest you. Then pop on in and you will be thrilled.
And before we get to the mailbag, let me just say, let us be lovers. We'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. So we bought a pack of cigarettes at Mrs. Wagner's Pies and walked off to look for America. That is the genius of Paul Simon. And it's a song called America. It's brilliant. Thanks to our guests today, Sally Jenkins and Bob Ryan. Thanks as well to today's sponsors. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Odyssey. If you get the show through Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review.
A quick rerun. The impairment categories for the Adaptive Open include intellectual impairment, lower limb impairment, multiple limb amputee, coordination impairment, seated player, short stature, upper limb impairment, and vision impairment. I want to use the correct terms.
That's good. That's good. Okay. From Greg Pollock in Aurora, Ohio. I'm finally catching up on the podcast after 8 weeks of not being able to drive due to multiple neck fractures. I previously wrote in about my annual golf trip with my brother's son and nephews, which took a tragic turn during a misguided attempt at body surfing. But I assume it didn't meet the literary criteria for the little audience, as it was a bit heavy on sentiment. The good news, however, is I'm back on the course. My head has never been steadier during my swing. I'm getting sentimental again with this message, sincerely hoping that you, Michael, and his sons get to share an experience like this. Back in 2009, played around with my father and my then 14-year-old son at Atwood Lake Resort near my hometown in New Philadelphia, Ohio. On the sixth hole of a par three executive course, my dad stepped up with his 5-iron, hit a low liner that cleared the ground by about 6 feet, caught the fringe on the front of the green, took 2 hops, rolled all the way into the cup. I've attached a picture that sits on my desk at work from that day, along with a scan of the plaque that hung in my parents' house. It's currently displayed in my garage, next to photos of my dad participating in the Richard Petty driving experience at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, another great experience I shared with my dad and one of my brothers. Beyond your regular guests, the most enjoyable part of your show is hearing about the experiences you share with Michael and his children. I hope you cherish those moments and they get to see Captain Tony or Farmer Tony or however listeners are referring to you on the day you get a hole-in-one playing with them. My dad passed away just over 4 years after that hole-in-one, never getting the chance to see his grandson graduate from high school. So this memory remains incredibly special to me. It's very, very nice, and it's a plaque. It's very nice.
Thank July 2nd. Last night we were laughing at dinner. Do you know what happened July 2nd, 2019?
No.
It's the day that you hit a goose with a golf ball.
Oh.
We're on the 15th. Okay, we could reset this.
Okay, that's it. Hold it.
You see the geese walking across the tee, and you start to shoo them away with the golf
club. Yeah, please. Come on, honey.
You step up to the ball. Liz is sitting there with Bootsy in the cart. I go, you better not lie. This one hit it thin. You hit it thin. And just
hit a goose. I didn't kill the goose.
You did not. You did not.
Goose was fine.
Goose was fine.
Goose walked away, then flew away.
That wasn't even the most memorable thing that happened on that front nine.
Well, that was when Carol drove into the water. Took the cart into the water. From Reese in London, dear Uncle Dr. Captain, are you sure you haven't planted magic beans? Keep an eye out for a goose-laying egg.
So they're very tall.
Well, they're really big.
Yeah.
They're really big. Dina near Denora, for the first time I planted potatoes. One variety is still green, but this variety was ready, and every time I thought I dug them all up, there was another, and she sends, oh my God.
That is
she
a
sends
hole.
Pictures of red potatoes. They're just 100 of them.
Yeah.
Wow. From Bob Lane.
Like
occasional
flex,
emailer Bob Lane from Midland, Michigan. When you purchased your first house on Long Island, I envision you with a full head of red, not orange hair, channeling Neil Diamond by reaching into your pocket, paying for it in cash. That probably impressed the woman to whom you're related by marriage even more than when her old boyfriend gave her a poem of Bob Dylan lyrics. Yeah. From Matthew Thomas in Bowmanville, Ontario, in Canada, near the Midwestern city of Toronto. Being a film buff, I couldn't resist respectfully submitting Some Like It Hot and Young Frankenstein for consideration of the greatest movie comedies ever. Would you consider these four for a movie Mount Rushmore? Look, they're very good. Some Like It Hot is a brilliant one.
Yes. Billy Wilder, I think, right?
Yeah, it's a sophisticated, brilliant comedy. It's not, you know, the comedies I'm talking about.
There's no food
it's a
fight
different,
scene.
Yeah, it's a different kind of comedy. Young Frankenstein, yeah, but that's not even his best movie.
No. Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles is his best movie.
Yeah.
From Steve the Sycophant, on Wednesday's show you referred to Animal House and the original Hangover as the two most brilliant comedies ever written. Let's calm down, little Sparky. those two laugh fests, great, of course, but please let me mention just two other movies. The Producers, for which Mel Brooks received an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay, and Woody Allen's Annie Hall, winner of the Oscar for Best Picture and 3 other Oscars. I could go on and on, but I'll stop here. Yeah, they're great.
They are
great. Yeah, everybody loves Annie Hall. Yeah, everybody loves them. Yeah, they're great. I just gave my two. I gave my two because they were so surprising all the time.
Yeah.
Just so surprising. From Brian R. in New York City. LeBron has the chance to do what Jordan never could. make the playoffs with the Wizards. That will end the GOAT debate.
Oh, Wilbon going crazy.
Jeff Alexander, Salinas, California. My family and I are making our biannual trip to West Yellowstone area next week. Hopefully Mr. Hobbs will be working on the day we sojourn into the park so we can yell the cheesery at an obscene volume at his grocery store. Also, we'll be staying a few days at my sister and brother-in-law's potato farm in northwest Montana. I'll let them know you said hello and that you'll see them at the Potato Expo 2027 in Denver on the 5th through the 7th of January 2027.
We got to book space for that.
From Seth Shaner in New Albany, Ohio. I write to you to enlist the help of Littles Everywhere and to share a story of a frightening night here at my home. The other night, my wife shook me awake at 12:43 a.m. to tell me that the garage door was opening. The opener is not far below our bedroom, and you can clearly hear it when it opens or closes. I rushed downstairs and investigated. There appeared to be no one around. I have cameras facing my driveway and the street from my front door, and neither were activated by motion. I have now learned that sometimes one must change the frequency on the garage door opener if it begins opening or closing randomly. I'd never heard of such a thing. Do you or the Littles have any advice? I'll hang up and listen.
Is it catching a neighbor's fob?
My only advice would be...
Maybe the snore is at the right frequency.
You know, take the door and smash it into bits and get a new door.
Well, get a priest because they may need an exorcism.
I don't know. From Steve Gilmore in San Angelo, Texas. Dear Potato Man. So Brian Windhorst disclosed that he was getting makeup done during the live podcast. For full disclosure, I'm not having makeup done while writing this email. From Jeff Greenfield. I'm 42, I'm a grown man, and I've been listening to every iteration of this show since we moved to Maryland from Forest Hills when I was 5 years old. Since moving right back to New York as an adult, my favorite things to listen to were the local D.C. weather reports and CVS excursions in the neighborhoods of Northwest D.C. that I've spent so much of my youth visiting friends and family nearby. It always made me feel closer to home, no matter how far I was. You can imagine my surprise and delight on Monday when I started hearing about your golf outing at my local course and describing the surrounding area to my neighborhood. Even your visit to Walgreens. I actually yelled out to myself in the car, I know that Walgreens. That's my Walgreens. Just one question. Why didn't you call first? I will hang up. He's from Island Park. Island Park is a little bit north of Lido Beach and Long Beach. Island Park, I believe, kids
still
go to
off
West
the Southern Central. State?
Oh, so well, Island Park is off Long Beach Road. You take Long Beach Road north, you go through Island Park. As soon as you get over the bridge, you're in Island
and
Park.
And Lido Beach, that's not where we get the song, the Lido Shuffle.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Okay.
That's Boss Gags. I don't know. From Marcia Thompson in Ocean View, Delaware. You know where Bear Trap is located? Do you think the Pope is responsible for the White Sox success this year? Possible divine intervention? I'll shut up and listen. I hadn't thought of that. That makes sense. Billy Flores in Houston, Texas. In reference to the Bears Hallmark movie, shouldn't we be looking for gazebos in Hammond, Indiana? That's funny. And one more. Don't worry about Paul Skeens. He's hanging out with Livy Dunn, DG. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
Harry, if we make an effort today, we might be able to save August. August? Tomorrow's the 4th of July, and we will be open for business. It's going to be one of the best summers we've ever had.
Unless you're eating.
Do the ribbons in my hair look far too girlish for the gray? Do we put our hearts away? Who says it's time? I'd rather not look foolish. Maybe I'm too old to do this. But we don't get to choose our prime, and yours might not be mine. 'Cause if we come too late to all we love, by the only road there was, do we not get to dance for as long as we can? If not for as long as we want, if not for as long as we want. Treasure in a day. an enemy, and I try not to agree. Did we come too late to all we love by the only road there was? Do we not get to dance for as long as we can? We want. The lines on my face, like the lines on the page. Can I trade the heartbreak for the song it brings? So I'll.
come away, sweet Madeline. For my soul, it feels like dancing too, yeah. Just take the keys in this hand of mine. It don't matter where we're driving to, no. Let the destination be unknown. Just start her up and let her go. Singing